Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1 with Allcare Pharmacy. Get expert advice from your friendly healthcare team at Allcare Pharmacy, Ireland's largest community pharmacy network.
Now, my next guest has appeared in the West End on Broadway and in Downton Abbey. The actor and playwright Rory Connaughan has also recently played the late David Trimble in Owen McCafferty's play Agreement. Rory, you're very, very welcome to the show.
Thank you, Devon. Now, happy to be here.
I will get to your roles in due course, but for the minute, I wanted just to talk about you. You've written this play called Lies Where It Falls, and it's inspired by a traumatic event that happened in your childhood. You grew up a child of the 70s during at the height of the Troubles in Maharafelt. What was that childhood like for you?
Well, I think lots of people of my generation lived in this kind of state of normlessness where there was a conflict going on around them, but that's all that we knew. So the understanding of what we lived through, I think, comes from where we are now. And those experiences that we had as children were just not normal. And I think now we're looking at these places and people where they're reacting to that experience. And in my case, it took 40 years for the actual trauma of the event to actually show itself. And I think there are a lot of people that are still living with that now.
Yeah, because you normalised it at the kids. But you probably, Rory, more than most, were aware of the politics of the Troubles because you came from a family that was steeped in politics.
We were. My father was very much involved in the SDLP. My uncle, Judge Rory Connaughan, was obviously in the judiciary at the time, but he was, a libertarian, and he was very keen to support social justice and the eventual change in Northern Ireland that he hoped would happen.
So home, and including your mum as well, I think she was probably one of your political influences as well, but it was a political home, politics was discussed, you were very, very keenly aware of what was going around you. There was an event that happened in your life which literally brought the reality of the Troubles home to you when your uncle was murdered. What happened?
My uncle was Judge Rory Connaughan, and he was...
From whom you were named, presumably?
I was named after, yes. Yeah. And he was one of the first Catholic judges murdered by the IRA. He was murdered in 1974.
That's complicated, isn't it? You know, that a Catholic judge was...
Well, I think, I mean, actually looking at the judicial murders throughout the conflict, there was clearly a policy of targeting Catholic judges. Not only Catholic judges, of course, because recently we're looking at the cases of Pat Finnegan and also Rosemary Nelson. But, you know, there was clearly, at that period, 1974, because my uncle, Judge Rory Connaughan, was also killed on the same day as Martin McBurney, who was another judge, but also a very strong left-wing trade unionist who was all about civil rights and civil liberties. So it was very clear there was some kind of policy to try and disrupt that by murdering these individuals.
You were, what, 7 or 8 at the time?
I was 8 years of age.
8 years time. What was that like for you and for your family?
Well, I think in terms of the play, that was the examination that I made. I mean, my uncle Rory Connaughan and my cousin, who was holding her father's hand when he was shot, they were at my birthday party about 4 days before, where I just turned 8. And that was a very exciting event for me because Uncle Rory had cheated his bodyguards to come. And so it was very thrilling and very exciting that he was there. And we were aware that he was an important man. And also I am and still am.
He must have been aware of the risks to himself.
He was, yes. He was aware of it. And in the stories that I hear, particularly from his daughters, about his understanding of that risk are kind of very traumatic in that he actually in some ways foresaw his own death. And felt that that might be exactly what happened to him. Although, interestingly, my father was involved in the SDLP at the time, and my uncle Rory was actually concerned about my father's well-being because, again, at that time, a number of SDLP politicians were targeted and were threatened. So That was one of the impacts of that killing was it was Judge Conaghan that was killed. And then my father then living the rest of his life, I suppose, understanding that at one stage he thought it was his brother was worrying about him rather than he worrying about his brother.
Do you have a recollection of the fear that, or that sense of risk that you as young children would have been living at the time? Like, I mean, I cannot imagine the trauma for your cousin who was literally holding her dad's hand.
Yeah, I mean, it's extraordinary, Darvel. I mean, I remember an incredibly happy childhood. And there was that sense of utter safety. I think after Rory's murder, that obviously changed. And we were suddenly aware of danger. And that was a fairly significant impact. But I think, like all people, particularly of my generation, there's a kind of silence that we've created in our brain where we think about, oh no, actually there wasn't really that much going on at that time. Well, yeah, we watched a few bombs going off and we heard about this, that or the other happening. But essentially now in recollection and looking back at that time.
Did it take, because I know you spent quite a long time living in London, did it take sort of moving away to look back and actually go, do you know what, that was our normal, but that wasn't, in fact, in any way normal.
Absolutely. But I mean, one of the reasons that I moved to London or certainly moved to England was to distance myself as much as I could from that legacy. And also, you know, I maintained my own silence for the 30 years that I was in London. Nobody knew about what had happened to my uncle, except perhaps just my wife and very close people.
And was that just like, I just need to get on with life. I don't need to articulate it or express it beyond. I don't need to bring it with me.
All of that. But also, I think a sense of kind of, would I be exploiting victim culture? Would by saying this, am I making myself more important than I actually am? And so that quiet was actually, I felt, very useful to me. But also, you know, because of my accent, because of who I was, a lot of castings involved, you know, political characters.
And did you get that thing which a lot of actors from the north of this island get, to be asked to play characters, you know, in relation to the Troubles, because you have that accent or you have that knowledge? Did you fight against, I don't know, being typecast in those roles? Or
I don't know if I did do that. I mean, what I did feel was I didn't really play anyone from a Republican kind of background, and not for any great moral stance particularly. I just thought I couldn't really give them truth. I think it would have been difficult for me to find that truth. That changed when I played Pat McGee. But so for most of my career, I avoided that.
Is it because you couldn't, because of what had happened in your family, give truth to their experience?
Indeed. And I think I also didn't want to go there in my head.
So you get your, there's this role that comes up. You're invited to play Patrick McGee, who was the Brighton bomber.
Yep.
That must have been very conflicting for you. Why did you take on the role?
Because
you'd had this policy of not going there.
Yeah, because of his relationship with Jo Berry. Jo Berry was the daughter of Tony Berry, who was killed in the Brighton bomb. And she reached out to Pat after he was released from prison as part of the Good Friday Agreement. And they formed their own kind of truth and reconciliation kind of team and travelled with that. And were very courageous and still courageous in the way that they expressed that. And so when I was offered the part of Pat, I thought, okay, this I can do because it's a reconciliation story. And, you know, I talked to my cousins, I talked to my family and said, you know, are you okay with me?
How did they feel about you taking on that role?
Well, they were supportive because they knew my thinking was right, I suppose. This was a really good story and it was an important story. Of course, what happened was part of that process was meeting Pat. And that's where I think the beginning of my kind of mental health issues began to...
Because you were meeting with someone who had committed those acts and who presumably had held a very, very strong beliefs in the campaign and everything. What was it like when you first met him? What was that first meeting like?
Well,
did you have to meet him or did you decide?
I chose to meet him. And it was useful. I mean, also, you know, the actor in me wanted to see him, to see his physicality, to see his you know, his voice, to get some kind of understanding of him. So we met and it was a very kind of civil conversation. It was a very, lots of platitudes from both of us. No real investigation into the psychic of Pat because I think I was too scared to go there. But what was going on in my head was something completely different. I was in this room with this man thinking, am I betraying everyone I love by just breathing the same air as this guy?
Did you feel you were betraying Judge Conahan's memory?
Or well, that was a fear. That was a fear. And I think it's something that we all live with in this kind of, the times that we are where, you know, as you saw in Agreement, where we talk about living cheek by jowl with each other. But, you know, I think there was great value in me telling this story. And I think it was great value in terms of producing and telling that story to other people.
I have seen you in Agreement and in other plays. And one of the things about you as an actor is that you don't just inhabit the roles, you nearly, if it's not too mad a phrase to use, both of us come from North Ireland, you occupy them. You occupy them. I've seen the way you take on these roles and the study and the research. I don't know, is it method acting or is it just the intensity with which you do that? That, I think probably does something to you physically as well as psychologically. I mean, how did it feel to occupy the mind, I guess, even if only for artistic purposes of someone like Patrick McGee?
Well, it was problematic. And I mean, there were some very good things to grab onto. One, you know, was, you know, he was a political young man and he was an intelligent young man. And, you know, he was politicized by civil rights. He was radicalized by internment. And then he was a soldier after Bloody Sunday. So there was a progression on Ballymurphy.
There was a journey.
There was a journey that he went to get to where he was. Now, the other thing about Pat was obviously after an attempt to assassinate Thatcher in terms of the reaction to him from the British press. I mean, he was, you know, talked in the same kind of words as Myra Hindley and Peter Sutcliffe. That was the kind of British interpretation of him.
And then he did go on a different path, which obviously led you to occupying him in that role. You could have probably taken a break at that point, but you went directly to star opposite.
Can't afford to take a break.
You went to directly into starring in Hamlet with none other than Benedict Cumberbatch. In hindsight, was that I suppose maybe it was the only choice you had, but what was happening to you at that point?
Well, it was literally days after I'd finished the Pat McGee play. And, it was the job of my career. I was absolutely thrilled. And it also felt right. It felt that I should be doing, you know, that was where I wanted to be. I wanted to be doing Shakespeare. I wanted to be doing these in the national theatres of all the countries of these islands. And here I was playing the Player King, you know, which is a tremendous part. Opposite, you know, Benedict, who was and still is one of the great actors of his generation. And Ciarán Hinds as well, who was playing Claudius. I mean, it was a phenomenal cast.
But what should have been the pinnacle for you in career terms and most likely was also an unravelling.
Yeah. Something kind of weird happened in that.
What role did the play have in that, in the role that you played?
Well, you know, the Player King has this speech which Hamlet requests about the murder of King Priam of Troy by Pyrrhus, who was a young assassin. And it's a very kind of brutal, descriptive, violent description of that particular murder, and also the reaction that it had to Hecuba, his wife, who saw the murder happening in front of her. And I began to see my uncle's murder. And I think one of the things that I did, and I think our family did, obviously not my cousins who were there at the time and actually were physically a part of it. But for us, I think what we didn't do was ever place ourselves in that moment. We didn't want to put ourselves there. It's too distressing. It's too horrible. But I saw it there. And it was disturbing and something weird happened to me. I fell very, very ill. First physically, literally my body collapsed. And then mentally, my mental health began to fail me. And then after that process, it was only through a lot of love from family and concern and care, also support of the company and ensemble that I was a part of at that time in Hamlet, to try and get me through this was, and that was an 8-9 month process. Which
was it a breakdown?
Well, I suppose in the old fashioned description, mm-hmm. it might be that. I mean, you know, you have different variations. My sister would very passionately argue that I got some kind of virus, and that virus then led to my mental health collapse.
Well, did you know what was happening if it sort of started as a physical thing and went into it? As you say, night after night, if you're doing that speech, if you're or in rehearsals, you're constantly being confronted with it. That is a trauma you've tried to bury just coming up, literally,
I mean,
night after night.
Just to clarify, it didn't happen night after night.
No.
You know, it happened maybe once or twice, but that was enough. Then I could make that separation. And you talk very, thank you very much, articulately about the idea of inhabiting a role. And as you, for example, with David Trimble. And there is that, but I think that's achieved in the rehearsal room or maybe in those first early performances where you really find what you want and then you take that forward. And then you have to achieve the technical things like being heard and being
yeah.
seen. But with Hamlet, the journey became very difficult, and there were moments where I drifted back into thinking about my uncle's murder around that. But I just didn't know what was happening. I didn't know what was going on.
Because one of the things that you say in the show notes to your new play is no one chooses the trauma. It lies where it falls. So
correct.
You sort of buried it for the best part of 40 years and then it came back. How did you recover from that?
A lot of love. I had therapy. I had medication. The thing that needed to be, I have a line in the play, which is there are only two certainties when you get unwell, is that you get worse or you get better. Those are the only two certainties you have. And very, very gradually, I began to see, in fact, it happened in Donegal after the long run that I did. I mean, we did 100 shows of Hamlet and I was unwell for pretty much all of those. They're very clearly, the funny thing though, Deborah, was it was the money was very good. And so that was also a great drive to stay in the show. But after that, my wife particularly, Katrina, knew and understood that I needed some kind of recovery period. So we went to Donegal and I stayed in Donegal. And being part of that winter in Donegal, which is a wonderful place to be at that time of year, and, you know, the pain, the weird thing that happened, I started to get chronic pain as well, which was very crippling. And we didn't know where this, what was this pain? You know, people talked about a condition called fibromyalgia or other conditions, but the pain was incredibly debilitating, as well as the fatigue I was suffering. But when we went to Donegal, the pain for some reason began to ease. Sleep was a disaster. And as I'm sure you know, and your listeners know, if you don't sleep, you go mad, and eventually you will die. I couldn't find a way to sleep. Medication helped with that. And very gradually, very slowly, things started to get better, and I think I fell into that world where I began to understand, oh, I think I will get better in here now.
Up until that point, Hamlet, arguably your Judge Conan's murder had been your little secret.
Mm-hmm.
It caught up with you.
Mm-hmm.
But actually, I don't know whether you find a way to metabolize it, but when you say the trauma lies where it falls, that is your artistic response, possibly. I know the show's going to open in London shortly. How important is that ability for people to tell their stories? Because I know people are coming up to you.
Yeah, well, that was one of the reactions that I didn't foresee when I first started Lies Where It Falls. Was that I talked about in that piece of writing I sent you, people would come to me and say, Rory, could I have a quiet word with you? Quiet being the operative mm-hmm. word. And people will then tell me their stories. And then also because of social media, you know, put myself on social media, people will then write to me with their stories. That was something I didn't foresee happening at all. That they saw this play and then they thought, actually, I'm gonna see if I can tell this guy what happened to me. And at first I was a little thrown by it, but then I understood why. And then actually it was a real kind of Damascene moment where I suddenly thought, by me telling this story, and because I have the skill set to do it, I can write a bit and I can act a bit and I understand theatre a bit. They've seen that. They maybe don't have my skill set, but they have an opportunity to tell it. And so that was the encouragement that I was seeing from my play, but also generally talking to people as the process went forward, and particularly...
And does your art help you? Because I did see you in Agreement, and I did see how you occupied very intensely the role of David Trimble.
Yeah.
And I'm just wondering, right down to his mannerisms, his facial expressions, his reactions, you really, really captured it. And I'm wondering, did that research for that role help you to see the conflict or the troubles from the other side?
Oh, absolutely. And I think that you know, one of the realizations that happened with me was, as I mentioned, I'm from an SDLP family. And, you know, we very strongly felt at the time that Hume should have had the Nobel Prize on his own.
Yeah.
That it was his and his alone. My view has completely changed on that now. I mean, having researched David and having met with people and having, you know, understood the shift in the that he made in making that agreement, get that agreement across the line. It was a phenomenal act of courage and a very pragmatic act of courage as well. I made the comparison that actually it wasn't dissimilar to Michael Collins, you know, in that, you know, he made that decision and in a sense, he literally signed his own death warrant. I said that Trimble signed, in a way, his political death warrant by making that decision. Although some wag very articulately said to me, yeah, but I'd prefer to have a pint with Michael Collins. And, well, I said, fair enough. But with David, you know, he was a difficult man and he was his relationships with people could be very curt and problematic, and he was not graced with great social skills. But yet this man was capable of now saving hundreds, perhaps thousands of lives by the decision that he made.
Sometimes I feel when we look all around us is legacy. We had Niall Breslin on the show yesterday talking about, you know, the legacy of our asylums, those mental health asylums at the time. You know, we've seen Cillian Murphy and Eileen Walsh, you know, really small things like these is taking off. And there is something about having space to tell those stories, and probably one of the things we haven't dealt with very, very well is legacy. Does art, does theatre, does what you have been through, which, you know, was your own trauma response, intergenerational trauma perhaps, more, well, direct in your family's case, but does art and theatre help us maybe get into that space where you can tell those stories?
Well, considering certainly with the last government policy in terms of the Legacy Act, you know, it would possibly be the only way to get those stories out there. I was blown away and incredibly moved by Colin Davidson's A Silent Testimony.
This was the wonderful exhibition of...
Yeah, yeah, of paintings of people that were dealing with grief from loved, lost... I mean, I think it's as important as Picasso's Guernica, I mean, in terms of an anti-war statement. I think Agreement is bringing that legacy conversation to everywhere that it plays in, both Belfast, New York and Dublin. I mean, Dublin, the reaction was phenomenal. We never expected
that. Were you surprised by that?
Yeah, I think we were. I think we were. We were thinking, well, what are they going to make of a load of Nordies shouting at each other? You know, but, you know, it was embraced extraordinarily. And that happened straight away, just the level of noise.
They were running matinees and Wednesdays.
Yeah, they were.
Yeah.
The level of noise in the first preview, for example, my God, where did that come from? And then we saw and understood that this is your history. This is your story as much as it is ours. And the embrace of that has been really warming and I think it is. I mean, we were caught in a bubble with it because we were walking in and out doing the show, being knackered and going home. But we didn't gauge. We knew there was, you know, we now know there was a huge conversation going around the place because of it.
What do you think when you look? Have you come back home? Have you?
Yes, yeah. I was in London. I moved back to
for a
to
long time.
25 years, yeah. And then we moved back to Belfast.
So almost for the entirety of the post conflict,
correct? Yeah.
Period.
Yeah.
What made you come home, and how do you feel now coming back and, you know, confronting that traumatic legacy in your own family?
I think what made us, well, my wife wanted to come home for a number of years before I did. I was very worried. My career's here. What are we? And my son, what about him? We have a, who's now 18, Shay. But what, I think the illness won the argument. And my wife, Katrina, was very keen that we find a life somewhere different, and going home, I think, was the way that that would be achieved. And for me, being the skeptic of that move, is now the champion of it. It was absolutely and definitely the best thing that we did, and we love it, and we love being home.
Ruaidh Conlon, it has been an absolute privilege chatting to you. For those of our listeners in London, Lies Where It Falls is at the Finborough Theatre in London from 26th of November to the 21st of December. Welcome home. We wish you all the best with the run. We're going to take a quick break.